Okay, last time we were looking at this Dirichlet series that I think I called ZMNS. Built out of the Clustermann sums, so SMNC. Summation e to 2 pi I C MD, no, MA plus ND, where AD is congruent to 1 mod C. So we run over all these and then choose the multiplicative inverse of D modulo C and stick it in there. And this is the Clustermann sum. And we related, I indicated how the Selberg spectral decomposition can be utilized to study this Dirichlet series. And using the theory of Poincaré series, that's the M over there, gamma Z. So looking at this is the Poincaré series that was introduced by Selberg in his fundamental 1965 paper, which more or less indicated in that paper how this particular series is linked to ZMNS. And Selberg proved the remarkable theorem that the abscissa of convergence of this particular Dirichlet series is related to the eigenvalue lambda 1 that we were discussing earlier. So remember that we proved, well, I didn't give all the details, but I indicated the proof of the theorem. Solberg, that the Dirichlet series ZMNS converges for real part S bigger than sigma naught, or rather, the better way to say this is this: it admits an analytic continuation, is analytic in the region real part S bigger than sigma naught, if and only if lambda 1 is greater than or equal to sigma naught, 1 minus sigma naught. So this is the theorem that Selberg had proved, and he did it by giving, more or less by Fourier analysis. Remember that the inner product of um with un leads to an expression which involves this Selberg-Clustermann zeta function. And on one hand, and on the other hand, you have Parseval's formula, which tells you that you can more or less compute the inner product with respect to the Mass waveforms and Eisenstein series, of course, which I've more or less ignored. But when you make the computation of um with a Mass form, UJ, psi j, let's say, it picks out the mth Fourier coefficient of psi j. And so plugging that back in, involved with the gamma functions that come in, we showed that, let's see, where was that? Yep. We showed that 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 the inner product um this inner product Pearson inner product is given by a beautiful expression which looks on the surface complicated, but it's not. But that's not the expression. To the minus s minus 1 pi inverse n to the minus 2 gamma of 2s plus 1. All of this is irrelevant. The relevant portion is here, plus where this is a highly convergent series which allows for the behavior of this tail part to be under control, and thus this being negligible, we immediately see that the series in question is really this this Pearson inner product of two Poincaré series. And when you Fourier analyze this using Parseval's formula, on the other hand, you can rewrite this as summation um, let's not bother with these arguments, psi j un plus contribution from Eisenstein series, which I will not bother writing. You get an expression now with these various inner products, and as I indicated last time, this inner product picks out the mth Fourier coefficient of psi j along with a gamma fudge factor, and the gamma fudge factor is equal to recall that un psi j comes out to be equal to the jth Fourier coefficient complex conjugate root pi over 4 pi n to the s minus a half gamma of s minus a half plus irj gamma of s minus a half minus irj divided by gamma of s, where a quarter lambda j equals a quarter plus rj squared is the eigenvalue corresponding to psi j. Thus, this fudge factor appears as in each of these expressions here, and allows us to relate the abscissa, or at least it allows us to deduce that this has analytic continuation into this half plane, if and only if this lambda 1, which is the smallest real eigenvalue, is under control. And all this criterion really comes from these gamma factors. So it's an amazing theorem. The details were not provided by Selberg in his paper. I think a good book to read is Motohashi's book, The Spectral Theory of the Riemann zeta function, where all the details are given. Of course, he's focusing on the full modular group, but that's okay. You still get the essential ideas by considering that case. So the details are there. Now, this... No. I think that this actually determines the the limit, the natural boundary, because you're going to get this expression involving these gamma factors, which are the singularities will correspond to these eigenvalues, and therefore that determines the natural boundary. Oh, that's a yeah. If you have lambda, it's a half. It's a half.
We don't, but we know
that's so the question is, if we know lambda 1 is bigger than a quarter, we know that sigma naught has to be a half, right? Oh, it's the same, it's the best result that comes out of your thing. No.
I know, but there is no other way of doing
this? No. Not that I know of.
Why did we come up with this condition? Why did we come up with the data function if there is no other way of doing this? And wasn't the data function to tell you things in number one?
Yeah, it is, I think. It's to determine lambda one. Oh no, but the fact that we have analytic information of this Dirichlet series now can be exploited in other questions, which I'm going to try and indicate now. Exactly. Yeah. 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 Well, I did that last week. Yeah. And I think your question is, why invent this series? Oh yeah. No. Yeah, yes. No, we don't. That's right. So this is going. That's right. This is the importance of this object is that it relates lambda one to other questions of analytic number theory, where these sums involving Clusterman sums will appear. Okay. As I think I will kind of. I think he was after the Selberg-Linick conjecture. I think he was after the conjecture about the averages of the Clusterman sums, which, as I indicate, as this theorem actually reveals, the Selberg-Linick conjecture is deeper than the eigenvalue conjecture in the sense that it implies it. The Selberg-Linick conjecture implies the lambda one bigger than a quarter, but we can't, not the other way around. And so, the reason for the study of Clusterman sums is revealed by much of the work of Ivanovich, where there's a sharp connection between the study of averages of Clusterman sums and classical questions of analytic number theory. Now, if you go back to history, now I think if I tell you some of the applications of the averages of Clusterman sums to questions of analytic number, it might help you. You want to know why this object has been created? Prove the Selberg conjecture. Yeah. Well, the way I understand things, which might not be the perfect way of understanding, but is that knowledge of lambda 1 tells you something about that Dirichlet series. Knowledge of the Dirichlet series then gives you information about questions in analytic number theory. Because the connection between lambda 1 and classical questions of analytic number theory is not obvious. Okay, so the first person who brought in the study of Clusterman sums into classical questions of number theory is Atkinson, who was a student of Titchmarsh, and he was studying moments of the zeta function. So he was trying to figure out the behavior of what are called moments of the zeta function. And at the moment, no pun intended, we only know the behavior of these integrals for k equals 1 and 2. Asymptotic behavior. Known only for k equals 1 and 2. The interesting thing is, for k equals 1, the expressions that arise in the analysis also led to the development of the large sieve theorem. So the kind of terms that come out for k equals 1 can be related to the large sieve, and for k equals 2, you really have to start using some of the more exotic Clusterman sums and things like this, so for even for k equals 2. So there's something GL1-ish about k equals 1 and something GL2-ish when it's k equals 2, and probably higher GLN will figure in for higher values of k. And at the moment, it's still very mysterious, and this is what this... the Keating and company have been trying to figure out what the constant that should go in into this asymptotic formula. So it's
this kind of setting so that in the non-arithmetic case you have
Yeah. But I mentioned that last time. That's right. So studying this from a larger perspective allows you to deduce that without using arithmetic, he concludes you can't really prove the Ramanujan conjecture.
It's a kind of setting to do this argument.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether you have another argument at all. Another argument is that somebody found themselves in here. I mean, somebody like the proposal to an attempt and say that he's only expanding to extend V so that he proves the Ramanujan. I mean, how seriously I take a proposal like that?
Well, let's be careful. This is on the internet, though. Well, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not going to pass any judgment on that one. The reason I'm mentioning Atkinson is because... I don't know. Okay? Now, the reason I'm mentioning Atkinson is because Atkinson actually is in Toronto. He was in Toronto. He passed away a few years ago, and so he was a student of Titchmarsh and had worked on this. So Atkinson is the first person to introduce Clusterman sums and to realize that Clusterman sums are important in analytic number theory questions. Although, of course, it goes back to Clusterman and the Hardy-Littlewood. The refinement of the Hardy-Littlewood method, but the zeta function has something to do with Clusterman sums. I think it was brought out first in his paper. And then the next person is Hooley, whose idea I'm going to outline now, which was then subsequently developed by Ivanovich and a whole host of other people to great advantage. So Hooley's remark is the following. So Hooley's remark. In sieve theory, we have a collection. We have a set A of integers and a set P of prime numbers. And each of the elements of script P will index some conditions that we would like the elements of A to satisfy. And so A sub P would be the elements of A in A. A satisfies conditions indexed by P. And so for each square free D, well, the sieve problem is to estimate the collection of elements that are remaining after you remove all these A sub P's. So the sieve problem is to look at the cardinality of this set. This is the sieve problem. The special case that has been the first has been the focus in the early research of Hooley is what's called the Brun-Tichmarsh question. Tichmarsh proved this using Brun's sieve. It's an estimate for the number of primes in a given arithmetic progression. So the number of primes P less than X, that the P is congruent to A modulo C, so I'm going to state this thing as refined by Montgomery and Wan. This is pronounced Vaughan, not Vogan. But this number is less than or equal to 2 times x times 5c log x over c for c less than x. This is the Montgomery-Vaughan estimate. Tichmarsh proved a thing with some constant c here, and in a smaller range than something like c less than x to the 1 minus epsilon. But this is the best result that sieve theory produces. And as I said, the kind of sums that arise in the analysis of the first moment of the zeta function, the second moment of the zeta function, rather, so when k equals 1 there, led to the development of what they call the Hilbert's inequality, which is basically the underlying inequality of the large sieve. And using that inequality, you get this sharp version of the count for the number of primes in a given arithmetic progression. And many people, for example, Chawla, I think, is the first, and then independently, Siebert, and later Motohashi, all unaware of the other people's work, noticed that if 2 can be improved to any constant c, well, I better not use c, to 2 minus epsilon, say, then LS chi, where chi is the Dirichlet character, LS chi is a real Dirichlet character mod C, has no Siegel zeros, so it has no zero, in has no real zero in 1 minus 1 over log C and 1. So this is a theorem that goes back in early papers of Chawla, although Chawla didn't have this log x over c factor, but rather log x instead of log x over c. And so his out of his theorem, you can't really extract this, but the finer version comes out of Siebert's work. So if you do that, you get that. So all of a sudden, you have an important link between improving this constant in the Brun-Titchmarsh theorem and showing that there are no Siegel zeros. So this is... this is called the problem of Siegel zeros. That is, we still don't know. I mean, this is a weaker version of the Riemann hypothesis. The Riemann hypothesis is true. There are no zeros at all on the real line between a half and one. But for real Dirichlet characters, LS chi, we don't know at this moment whether there are any zeros in that little interval or not. Okay. However, Hooley observed that the two-factor in the Brun-Titchmarsh theorem comes because of poor estimation in a fundamental problem. And what is this fundamental problem? It is to count the number of numbers less than x in an arithmetic progression. So how do we count the number? So this problem is, number of n less than x such that n is congruent to A mod C. So how do you count these numbers? So, well, n must look like C times T plus A, and we want this to be less than or equal to x. C and A are fixed. So this is the same as counting the number of T's which are less than or equal to x minus a over c. That looks pretty simple enough. Okay, the number of such things is, well, it looks like it's x minus a over c. Looks like that, but it isn't. And it isn't because that's only counting t positive. When t is zero, you have to count that too, or you may if you may have to count it, or you may not count it if x is smaller than a or something silly like that. You won't count it. So you really have to. This is it. Now, looks like a trivial remark, but that's the number. Now, by the way, the greatest integer of a negative number, okay, so, this all means that if x is less than a, it should be zero, okay? And this picks out zero at that point. Otherwise, you won't. All right. So now, having... Nope. Okay. So it's all a question of whether you're going to count the a or not. Exactly, exactly. So if a is less than x, you count it in. Because it doesn't really matter. Yeah, but I'll do it anyway. But it does give the right tally. Yeah, for symmetry's sake. Okay, so if a is less than x, we count it in. If x is less than a, we better not count it, and this comes out zero. For symmetry's sake. And as I said, it's going to matter now when I Fourier analyze this expression. Okay. Now, normally, I mean, in SIF theory, you're always concerned about number of integers divisible by D or something like that. And when you look at that expression, a number of integers divisible by C, you see that the main term is like x over c, and then you put an error term of O of 1. And this is where Hooley says you should be very careful. Don't do that. That O of 1 is responsible for the 2. And if you want to beat the 2, you have to Fourier analyze the error term. So normally in SIF theory, we estimate this quantity as x over c plus O of 1, which looks harmless enough. Something bounded, you know, the main term is x over c and error term is O of 1. It's fine enough. And you go happily into all these SIF questions with using this kind of a weak version. And for most purposes, it works. It's quite possible that even this parity phenomenon of SIF theory, where the SIF machine at the moment cannot decide between when a number has an even number of prime factors and an odd number of prime factors, it's called a parity problem in SIF theory, which no one knows how to solve, it's possible that a finer Fourier analysis or Clustermann sums may resolve it. And that suspicion, I think, is substantiated largely by the work of Ivanovich, who managed to improve much of the stuff that came out of classical SIF theory when there was really no good reason that you could, but by you doing this kind of an analysis. Now, so Hooley's idea is to Fourier analyze the error term. After having written it exactly like that, so what you would do is you introduce this function psi of x, which is x minus greatest integer of x minus a half. This function is periodic with period 1, periodic function, period 1. And you can write down a Fourier series for it. Well, it's not absolutely convergent, but you can write it down anyway. Sine 2 pi hx over pi h. You just do the calculation. How do you write down a Fourier series? You write down the integral, just do the calculation, and this is what you end up getting. But this thing is useless for purposes of analytic number theory. So what you do is you truncate it. Now, if I don't watch out, I'll be giving a course in SIF theory. But you truncate it in this fashion, and you get now two expressions. Notice that that if we want to now count. We want to count to count the number of primes p less than x, p congruent to a mod c, we will consider the sequence elements n less than x, which are first congruent to A mod C, and then each of these conditions, A sub P, will be the number of n's in A which are not divisible by P, or rather which are divisible by P. So P divides n. Now, by the inclusion-exclusion principle, the expression SAP can be written as, with the Mobius function, A sub D over D, where A sub D is the collection of numbers, just the intersection of A sub P's, where P divides D. So let's look at A sub D for a moment. A sub D will be the collection of n's, the collection of n's less than x, n congruent to A mod C, but it will have to be divisible by every prime dividing n, so it will also have to be divisible by n. And the number of such things so n looks like D times T, and D times T has to be congruent to A mod C, and that's the same as saying T has to be congruent to D bar A mod C. So how many numbers T less than or equal to X, so T could be 0 too, by the way, so how many numbers are there less than or equal to X which are congruent to D A mod C? So clearly it will come out to be the main term, the number of such things, number A sub D turns out to be X over D plus an error term, where the error term can be written now in terms of this Fourier series. It will involve, so the error term is given by that expression, it'll be sine 2 pi h d bar a over c over h. Let me just put this. So the point is that this is really the imaginary part of either 2 pi I h a d bar over c. And when you're trying to, in SIF theory, you will get the average the averages of the error terms that you'll have to estimate. And when you do that, when you add this up, you will be getting Clusterman sums. See, the inverse of D mod C appears in these factors, and then you'll be averaging over various C's. So what these guys have done, Ivanovich Kulis was the first to obtain an improvement. The kind of result that they obtain is they improve the constant 2, but for almost all progressions. So they start, if you were to improve the constant 2 for all progressions, you would be showing that there are no Siegel zeros, which is still a major unsolved problem. However, which means that there has to be some one more link, one more a new idea in order to solve the Siegel zero problem. But this at least indicates briefly how Clusterman sums enter into the picture of the analysis of error terms in sieve theory and related questions. Depending on how time will allow me later in the semester, I want to also look at questions which are called shifted divisor problems. So if d of n is a number of divisors of n, then a shifted divisor problem is a question about the asymptotic behavior of this divisor, this quantity. Okay. It looks like a kind of, you know, just made it up or something, but it's really not. One can also consider the cognate questions of looking at a sub f of n plus h or something for some fixed h, where a sub f of n is a Fourier coefficient of some sort of cusp form. And these are all called shifted divisor questions. Now, what does this have to do with Clusterman sums and related theory? Well, if you rewrite this sum, it becomes almost obvious. What is d of n after all? It's the number of factorizations of n as a times b, okay? And what is d of n plus 1? It's the number of factorizations of n plus 1 as c times delta or something. So let's see. So a times b, sorry, I used d, but anyway, I shouldn't have done that. A times b is n, and c times delta is n plus 1. And we're trying to count the number of n less than x that do that. And so immediately you see that you're really counting matrices a, b, a, a, what is it, a, yeah, maybe I should put b here, a, b, delta, c. Do I have it right? Nope. C delta B A. Let's do it that way. So that's C delta minus A B is 1. So the determinant of this is 1. So we're really counting matrices in SL2Z of determinant 1 with the proviso that, of course, A delta is N, and which is less than or equal to X. Okay, so as long as the product of AB is N, and as long as the product of AB is less than X, and the determinant of this matrix is 1, you're counting these things. And it's like a lattice point question in some hyperbolic space, and this also immediately leads to Clusterman sums. That's kind of evident if you fix B, so you have AB minus C delta equals 1. You can see that if you fix C, so fixing C, you more or less say that this is C delta plus 1. It's B has to be the multiplicative inverse. Anyway, you can rewrite this thing in terms of Clusterman sums again, and this is another set of questions of classical analytic number theory that involve the study of Clusterman sums. And again, these do appear in Atkinson's early work, Atkinson and Estermann, where they were studying shifted divisor problems but had no connection, no clue that they were related to the spectral theory of the Laplace operator, which is what this is all about. So now, One more point that I want to make concerning Clustermann sums is the study of what are called hyper-Clustermann sums. If you have a finite field of p elements, the expression e to the 2 pi I over p a1 x1 plus a2 x2 plus ar xr. I fix my fix for fixed a, fix a1 to ar mod p, and consider these this Clustermann sum where the summation is over all the xi's, so there are variables here mod p, with the condition that the product of the xi's is 1 mod p. I mean, nothing special about 1. It could be in some fixed residue class. The product of xi's is in some fixed residue class mod p. These are all called hyper-Clustermann sums. And they were estimated by de Lin as a consequence of his proof of the Weyl conjectures for varieties. And so these hyper-Clustermann sums, we know that they are bounded by two times p to the r over two. R variables, and you get something like this. So this is R minus 1 over 2. Because really, there are only, you know, the number of variables is really R minus 1 rather than R. So this is a theorem of consequence of de Lin. So these are what are called hyper-Clustermann sums. And it's amazing that hyper-Clustermann sums also make their appearance in questions of classical analytic number theory. I want to show that now. So, elementary remark. How do you create hyper-Clustermann sums? How do hyper-Clustermann sums arise? How do they arise? Well, they arise rather naturally if you take Gauss sums, raise them to the rth power, and a sum over characters. Okay, so let me review a little bit about Gauss sums. So, so let g of chi be the Gauss sum p, so a mod p. So g of chi is summation chi of a e to the 2 pi I a over p, so it's called the Gauss sum. If you've never seen these before, a good place to study them is Ireland and Rosen's book. Okay, since there are some undergraduates here, Ireland and Rosen. The earlier edition, the better. Right. What? Yeah, but I don't recommend. I'm trying to recommend a book that an undergraduate can read. I better be careful. This is being broadcast on the internet. What? Anyway, g of chi has absolute value root p according to the classical calculation of Gauss. Now what happens if we were to take g of chi to the arc power and sum over chi mod p, all the Dirichlet characters? Let's look at this. What happens is you end up getting chi of A1, chi of AR. I think, did I do something lousy again? Check that. No, it's okay. Chi of A1 to AR, either 2 pi I over P, A1 plus AR. And what are we doing here? We're summing over chi mod P, and we're summing over all the A1s to AR mod P. Okay. If we push the summation of chi inside, as is natural to do, you will see that this becomes summation A1 to AR, either 2 pi I over P, A1 to AR, and inside you have chi of A1 AR, you're summing over chi mod P. Then by the orthogonality relations for Dirichlet characters, you see that this is zero unless A1 to AR is congruent to 1 mod P, in which case it is P minus 1. So it's equal to P minus 1 . So the arc moments of the Gauss sum are related to the r-dimensional hyper-Clustermann sums. And this observation has led some to study, as I mentioned in my earlier lectures about studying sequences and Sato-Tate property. If you want to study the distribution of sequences, it's natural to consider moments of such sequences. So if you were thinking of trying to study the moment distribution function of Gauss sums, the moment distribution function of Gauss sum is really the hyper-Clustermann sum. So knowledge of the behavior of the estimates for this allows you to deduce that the Gauss sums are uniformly distributed. This is a theorem, I think, proved by Moreno or Katz, one of the two. I'm not sure which one. But anyway, so this is a hyper-Clustermann sum. And they make their appearance rather naturally in analytic number theory and in the context of automorphic L functions, especially because Gauss sums appear as root numbers on L functions. And when you start considering symmetric power L functions, the powers of Gauss sums enter. Okay, now I want to discuss a new theme in trying to attack the Ramanujan conjecture and the eigenvalue conjectures based on the notion of averaging, okay, where all of these things will kind of make their appearance in a natural way. So the method of averaging and twisting. Some of the notion of averaging already is apparent in trying to study the Selberg-Linick conjecture, because there we know that if you take the individual an estimate for an individual Clustermann sum and plug that back in, you're only going to get 3 over 16. Selberg's observation was that if you average the Clustermann sums, and take advantage of the cancellation of the angles, you should do better. And this is a familiar theme in, you know, all of analytic number theory, where if you average out things instead of applying absolute value to individual terms, you can take advantage of the cancellation that goes on. So the method of averaging, in the context of at least estimating Fourier coefficients of cusp forms, was began in a paper by Duke and Ivanovich, and I'll outline that thing, and then I will talk about the refined method, where you modify this method of averaging and by twisting and incorporate that as well, and take advantage of double averaging, and then that's how you get all your improvements of lambda 1 that you, in your latest paper, the appendix by yourself and Sarnak. This is how you get these improvements. So it's a Duke Ivanovich method. Let A be a sequence of complex numbers. And suppose that the Dirichlet series that one would naturally associate to the thing converges absolutely for real part s bigger than 1. And for each Dirichlet character, chi mod the q let us look at what's called a twisted Dirichlet series. We consider the twist Dirichlet series AS chi that, and we also assume that it converges, it obviously converges for absolutely for real part s bigger than 1, because the characters are of absolute value 1. Now, perhaps inspired by Weyl's converse theory, where you would look at a sequence of numbers and look at all the twists, the Dirichlet series attached to the twist, and if you assume all the appropriate functional equations, you can then deduce that the thing comes from a modular form. It makes sense to assume then that all of these twisted Dirichlet series perhaps have some sort of functional equation, not the shape that's given by Weyl's converse theorem, but something like the following. Suppose that each AS chi can be analytically continued in practice. Q is going to be prime, so can be analytically continued to an entire function for chi non-trivial. You could do this when Q is not a prime also, but you have to worry about primitive characters and non-primitive characters. But so in order to avoid that technical consideration, let's just assume Q prime. Suppose AS chi can be analytically continued to an entire function for all non-principal characters, and that it satisfies a functional equation of the following shape. where epsilon chi is a root number, phi of s is usually a bunch of quotients of gamma functions. Phi of s is holomorphic for real part s bigger than 1. And phi of s looks like gamma of s over gamma of 1 minus s with gamma of s. The precise shape of these gamma factors is not that important. All that will be necessary is the growth of these things in practice. But anyway, I have not seen any of this applied where you didn't have precise information of this kind. Where real part of mu j is bigger than or equal to minus a half. And epsilon chi is the Gauss sum g chi, already defined, divided by root q to the power k. What's the exponent? Oh, ks over 2. Yeah, sorry. So you're given a sequence of numbers, you make these assumptions about these Dirichlet series, and what you should mentally think about is a situation where you have a cuspidal automorphic representation, and the coefficients a sub n would be the L function, the coefficients of the Dirichlet series defined by the cuspidal automorphic representation, and you can take this and twist it by Dirichlet characters, and they are going to be entire functions, usually, you know, unless it's some silly thing. And you know when it's going to have a pole. And so this is a natural thing to expect. That's why it's going to be important to know all the factors, all the local factors. It's not good enough to know partial L functions have analytic continuation. That's not good enough for this method to work. Because what we're going to do is, we're going to take this thing and we're going to continue it and then to the left half plane and apply the functional equation. I'll show you the technique in a second. So what is the content of their theorem? The content of their theorem is the following. Under these conditions, oh, one more assumption. Let's suppose that phi of s is bounded by qs to the 2 sigma minus 1 c on real part s equal to sigma, which is bigger than 1. Constant here depending on sigma. And the sign and the functional, so this is one assumption, suppose one, this. Suppose second, that the sign and the functional equation is somehow randomly distributed in the following sense. In the following sense. Here, the summation is over all but finitely many characters. Possibly finitely many characters mod q. So what do we want? We want this information for this condition. I haven't made this final conclusion of the theorem yet. So I'm assuming this, and I'm assuming that the summation over all the, how many characters do I have? I've got Q characters. All characters mod Q. All characters mod Q. Let's not worry about this. Let's in fact ignore this comment for the time being. Think of it as chi not trivial. What it's supposed to include is a trivial character, but there might be other characters where I might not have information. You know, the automorphic forms industry might not have supplied me with the, you know, the required analyticity properties for a certain finite number of characters, and therefore I can throw them out. And oh, it's an art form. That's right. Sometimes, yeah, some things that might be problematic. Some finite number of characters will give you some problem. You can throw them. Actually, a little O of Q to half is enough. But this is not surprising because I just said that if you ignore the chi of A there, the factor, what you have there are hyper-Klosterman sums. Because I already mentioned to you that when you take rth powers of the Gauss sums and you average over characters, you're getting hyper-Klosterman sums for which you have Dillon's estimate. And if you twist it by a character like that, it's just not going to make it matter. It's going to be some other residue class because that A will pop. See, if I stuck in chi of A in here, and I fixed the chi of A there, what's going to happen is A times A1 to AR has to be congruent to 1 mod P. Well, I did it here. So there will be an A in here. And A times A1 to AR is going to be congruent to 1 mod P. And still, it's one of these hyper-Klosterman sums for which we have this estimate. So this is really a hyper-Klosterman sum. All primes Q. Yeah. And all, in fact, what is needed is for all primes Q on a set of density 1, but let's not worry about these constraints on a set of density 1. For the purpose of understanding it, it's enough to assume that you have it for all primes Q. Under these conditions, so these are the conditions of the theorem, then the theorem says, that An is less than n to the power 2c minus 1 over 2c plus 1 plus epsilon for any epsilon positive. That's the conclusion of the theorem. The c is the c that appeared in the estimate for the gamma factors. Now, if you think about it for a moment, what is that C? Remember that the phi of S is a quotients of gamma functions. Okay? And you have Stirling's formula, which tells you the asymptotic behavior of the gamma function. And you plug that back in here, it turns out that C is equal to K in practice. What's called the dimension of a Dirichlet series in Selberg's theory. So C is equal to K. So you're getting something like 2K minus 1 over 2K plus 1. So you're beating what would be the trivial estimate of n to the 1 plus epsilon, because the Dirichlet series converges absolutely to the right of 1. And a simple exercise in analytic number theory will tell you that every coefficient has to be O of n to the 1 plus epsilon. Once you have any Dirichlet series that does that. So here's their method. So here's the proof. So this will be not a detailed proof, but a sketch. So let F be a smooth, meaning infinitely differentiable, smooth, compactly supported Uh, function on R plus the positive reals. This condition only is for the purposes of convergence. It's not essential for the understanding of the idea. So we're going to look at various related quantities . So we're going to define a FQL to be summation AN FN, where N is congruent to L mod Q, and we will define AF of chi to be summation AN chi N FN. And what's the relationship between this and this? Well, you know, using orthogonality relations, you can write AFQL as a linear combination of the AF chi's chi mod Q by orthogonality. Now, if chi is not the trivial character, or is not one of these characters for which we don't have the information, we can we now apply one of the most one of the deepest ideas of mathematics. One of the deepest ideas of mathematics is, if you have a function f, you write it as a transformer of something else. I don't know why this works. See? You make it more complicated than less, you know, by take f and write it as sum of things. You know, the whole theory of approximation is, how well can you write one as a sum of small things? So you write f. Yeah. So write f of x . So that is, we're going to write f of x as a Mellon transform of something else. Okay, so this is usually called a Mellon transform. It's a different version of Laplace transform after changing variables, but it's more or less it. And this is a vertical line integral on the line near particle sigma. So we will then, the reason you'll see in a second why we do it. So you're trying to understand AFQL. This is the quantity you want to really understand, which by this formula, to understand AFQL, it's tantamount to understanding AF chi's. So it makes sense to look at AF chi summation chi n an fn over n, and then writing f of n as another sum, as another integral rather, chi n an 1 over 2 pi I n to the minus s ds. And now you see why you want to write that. You do the obvious, and the function f has been you know, confined to these conditions so that everything is kosher. You know, you can kind of justify everything. So you end up getting 1 over 2 pi I sigma, and inside, when you take it in, you've got f of s as chi ds. So you've managed to write the quantity that you want to study as some sort of vertical line integral of these functions which you do know something about. Okay? And now, you do what is usually obvious in analytic number theory. So here's this vertical line integral. You truncate it at some big T. You make a contour. Let's say this is positive T minus capital T up to minus capital U or something. Let me not do that. Let me do eta here. Just want that. So, or minus eta if you like. So what happens now is we're assuming that AS chi's are analytically continuable to an entire function. We also have it extends to an entire function by the fragment Lindelof principle. You're able to deduce that this thing is of polynomial growth inside, and so all these integrals can be these horizontal line integrals can be shown to go to zero as t goes to infinity. And so what you do is you can rewrite this thing as so move the line of integration to real part s equal to minus eta. Okay? So that this becomes so that AF chi equals 1 over 2 pi I, maybe with the minus sign, but anyway. So this by Cauchy's theorem, you see the integral over this region is 0 because there's no poles inside, okay? Therefore, this vertical line integral is equal to this line integral. So you end up getting something like this. You end up getting the same thing, of course, f of s as chi ds on this line minus eta. Okay. And now you apply the functional equation, so as chi, I didn't rig it up correctly, but anyway, you can see it. AS chi is going to be related to AS1 minus S chi bar with the appropriate gamma factors. So what we end up getting is that this is equal to, by the functional equation, this is going to be equal to 1 over 2 pi I F1 minus S A1 minus S chi bar times some divided by 1 over five S and epsilon chi bar. There's no reason to shift in F, thank you. That's F of S, thank you. Yep. Okay. And so, now, what we will do is we will rewrite we'll change variables. 1 minus s becomes now 1 plus eta. So you can change this as a line integral on 1 plus eta, which is now in the domain of absolute convergence again. It's a beautiful trick. I mean, move the integral to the left of half plane, apply the functional equation, you're back into the right half plane again, and you're in the region of absolute convergence. Therefore, you can shift integrals and sums around. And so you end up getting various things, so you end up getting something that can be written as A G chi bar I actually think it there should be a bar here, but in my notes and in the paper, it's just epsilon chi, but that's irrelevant. Let's put it in for accuracy's sake. And what's this G? Well, remember, I picked my capital F to be the inverse Mellon transform of little f. And so this has now fudged up the original function f, so it's going to be a new function, some other new function, so you're going to get some other g. So where g of y is the obvious, 1 over 2 pi I, 1 plus eta, f of s, there. And the point is that G depends only on the parity of chi, but not on chi otherwise. But let's not worry about that technical remark. Okay, now, slowly getting to the final punchline. And I'm also going to ignore these comments about exceptional characters and whatnot. So what happens now is that if you want to estimate AFQL, well, AFQL is going to be equal to for each of these, I will use the fact that it's equal to 1 over 5q, summation chi bar of L, epsilon chi bar of AG of chi bar. Okay, so the advantage of having this relation AF chi being related to AG chi bar, which we got by the functional equation, and invoking the fact that the AS chi extended to an entire function, allows us to replace this thing by AG chi with these powers of the Gauss sums. And now, the question is how to estimate this thing. Well, you rewrite this back in terms of 1 over 5q, summation chi bar of L, epsilon chi bar, summation chi bar of N, AN, GN. And just the definition, just plug the definition now back in, okay? And you do the interchange of summations. These are all finite sums, so that one ends up getting summation n, an, gn, okay. And here you have a hyper-Clustermann sum, okay? And so this is when Dillon comes in, so you're invoking the cancellation property of all these things. And then you just put absolute values on everything else. So this is the trick. This is the technique. It's a technique which I don't understand why it works, because you see this is a standard method in analytic number theory, where in order to understand something you make it more complicated. Maybe it's a technique of mathematics, but anyway, you invoke some sort of transform into the middle of the things, which kind of undoes and unshuffles everything around. Now, thus, we obtain, I'll give the more nitty-gritty details in the notes on the web page, so you end up getting that AFQL is less than Q to the minus half summation M A sub M G of M after you do all the now you might be wondering, where did I get Q to the minus a half? The hyperclusterman sum gives you Q to the half, but there's a Q outside, 1 over 5 Q outside, so it's Q to the minus a half. So you end up getting this remarkable saving. And now it's just a question, so this is a general setup, it's just a question of choosing appropriate test functions. And when you choose the appropriate test function, there's a good choice that you can make. You end up showing, by choosing an appropriate test function, see, another interesting thing is it an appropriate little f? No, it's not an appropriate little f, it's an appropriate big F. Your little f was there, but the big F has been defined by the inverse Mellon transform. And by choosing big F conveniently so that all these estimates go through neatly, and especially remember, this part has to be estimated appropriately, you end up getting that and hence little f by Mellon inversion you end up getting that AF of QL is bounded by Q to the C minus a half plus epsilon. Now I've run out of time. Perhaps what I'll do next time is show finally how from there you go and actually deduce this and how you would apply this in practice to the estimation of Fourier coefficients of Mach forms. There you would apply it to the symmetric square L function. And then now that we have the symmetric fourth power L function, which is automorphic, that's important to know that it's automorphic. Remember, the root is holomorphy, and then automorphy, and then back again, you take Rankine-Selberg and establish more holomorphy and more automorphy. So now that we know that the fourth symmetric power L function is automorphic, you know that all the twists of the automorphic L function of the Mach form, GL to L function, will satisfy all the hypothesis theorem. Therefore, you end up getting good estimates for these Fourier coefficients. Okay, next time what I will do is show how by averaging L functions, so I said there's a method of averaging and twisting. So once we just discuss twisting now, and then we will discuss averaging, fix a beta naught, and we twist by these Dirichlet characters, and we average over the chi's, and then we do a double average, chi mod q, and q in a certain range. So we do a double average and show that these sums are large, and then from this information that these sums are large, we're able to deduce estimates for both the Fourier coefficients and the eigenvalue problem. So this is another approach to both the Ramanujan conjecture and the eigenvalue conjecture, which kind of circumvents trying to establish the holomorphy of all the symmetric power L functions. Okay. But so at the moment, the way the method stands is the symmetric power L functions give us one crude estimate, and then you can fine-tune the estimates by using these methods and get a slight improvement beyond the obvious Rankine-Selberg method. Okay. Yeah, it's important. And that's going to enter into the C.